Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for tales and related discussions, internet style.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. This week, we discuss outrageous rumors about the 50th anniversary special and take an emotional journey revisiting everyone's favorite companion, Donna Noble. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten. Steve-O can just write pretty much anything, and we're just going to be like, oh, that's awesome. And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Whovian name.
And Keir Hansen.
I'm holding up for cat fight.
Welcome to episode 22 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where this evening we're going to act like Donna Noble and try to make the world better by shouting directly at it. Oi, what? Spaceman? Martians. My name is Keir, taking the intro for this evening for the first time. I think I'm going to do all right. I'm breathing deeply. I'm doing my yoga. I'll be okay.
So far, so good.
Yeah, all right. And joined, as always, are the eponymous Melissa. Hello.
Hey, guys.
And Jay.
How's it going?
So what have we got on the docket here today? We've got plenty of news. It's starting to ramp up hard and fast.
Yes, it is. Well, I mean, the thing today, as we record this, is actually the 23rd. So today is actually the first day that you can go out and get the book of the First Doctor, the line of books that the Puffin Publishing is putting out. So we get the first one today, the one by Ian Colfer. So
yes, I'm actually going to pick up my copy on Friday.
Yeah,
I'll download my copy.
I'm kind of
broke.
Oh no.
I know.
This is why I'm waiting until Friday. Friday to pay.
Yeah, I'm kind of in flux. I'm like, I really want to get it, but at the same time, once they're done with all 11 stories, they're going to release it in a bound copy with all 11.
Are they really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I'm like, I kind of want to hold out for that. I'm like, on one hand, I'm like, it's what, $3, something like that, but then I can get all of them at the end instead. And I don't know.
But other people are going to have read them for months and months ahead of time waiting for the publication of all the stories. It's going to drive you nuts.
It really is. I know.
You might end up wanting to pick and choose certain ones based on the author, based on the doctor.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it plays out by the end of the week. But yeah, that makes it exactly 10 months until the 50th anniversary from today. So slightly under 10 months when you're listening to this.
Right. And of course you can't have this home stretch, to the 50th without the wild and crazy rumor of the week.
Oh, yes.
We've got the biggest unconfirmed ball of turd that we've dealt with yet.
Yeah, this is
fan mail.
This is really the most awesome and yet most wildly, you know, improbable rumor that I've heard yet.
Yeah, it's got no basis behind it other than wishful thinking,
yeah,
as far as I can see.
And yeah,
Can you guys just explain for the audience the
rumor that we're talking about is that there have been numerous articles popping up all over the internet that the 50th anniversary special will include all 11 doctors.
Oh, okay. I have heard this, and I thought that might be what you guys were talking about.
Some, if it's just a little clip, the article I was reading was saying that for the first three doctors, they're going to include like a clip or some, you know, special effects kind of magic or whatever to make it seem like they're in it somehow. I'm not sure. They're very ambiguous in this, just probably because they have absolutely no facts to go on. But supposedly Chris Eccleston has been saying that he's rethinking his earlier decision not to have done it, and you know, it's there's no fact to go on at all, but at the same time, it's one of those rumors that you just can't help but pray that somehow it does come through.
But speaking specifically with regards to Eccleston, at the same time, just this past week, they've announced that he's going to be going forward with the production for that for this 1984 interpretation that he's working on. They're doing another variation of the original story, and I think they're doing it as I want to say they were doing it as a BBC two-parter, but they're going to be these long-form miniseries. So that's supposed to keep him in production for months, So again, you got to wonder if this is just a matter of either they are pulling the greatest red herring of all time and having all of these confirmed and unconfirmed actors just screwing with us for months and months on end just to say, ha ha, and then yeah. spring this.
Which I wouldn't put thing. Past them.
No,
but then you also have to consider if, you know, if they're really just trying to put them all in there so that they can say they're a part of it. You know, somebody send, you know, go over to Eccleston's house with a little camcorder for, you know, 2 hours on a Saturday, and, you know, that's all you really need. It's, if they just want a cameo, then they can cram that into his schedule.
Sure. Have the actor's likeness on screen as people are walking mm-hmm. past a bank of televisions, you know?
Yeah.
That counts.
Yeah, or even just footage from another episode mm-hmm. spliced in there expertly.
So, I mean, yeah, there's nothing to go on, and I keep telling myself that it's not going to happen, but I know that this is one of those pipe dreams that's going to wind up breaking my heart.
Yeah. All right, yeah, so we're being cautiously optimistic about this, or pessimistic in general.
I was going to say, there's not much optimism here. Yeah. It's just
I think we would hope that it actually did happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, and then of course we've got the BBC America specials that are going on once a month that mm-hmm. That we talked about last week, starting with the Aztecs on the 27th. So, actually, let me see. I don't think we mentioned this last week. I think this is actually new news that they're actually going to be doing episodes of the Doctors.
The plan is that they were going to take each of the Doctors going through. Mm-hmm. Each month leading through and offer up what is going to be the, you know, this great prime example, of that Doctor in their, you know, their grace moments, you know, their real heyday. Yes. What do you do with the eighth? I don't really know. Unless they actually air the entire movie.
What?
Which would be kind of cool.
That would be awesome. I might have to get BBC America if they're going to do that. That might be worth it. Yeah, but so they're starting out with the Aztecs. God only knows what they're going to do for the second Doctor. Then it'll probably be like, you know, Spearhead from Space. And
Guaranteed.
And City of Death, probably for the fourth Doctor, you know. Just picking out the, you know, the most recognizable or best example of that Doctor or whatever it is. So it's, mm-hmm. yeah, we could probably speculate on them, but I know 2/3 of the cast here doesn't have enough experience with Classic Who to really speculate in depth.
Well, what I was going to say is that all the things that you're predicting, we've already actually talked about a couple of those. You know, we talked about the Aztecs, we talked about City of Death, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, I was going to say maybe we could watch them and talk about those episodes, but these are actually really all the ones that we are familiar with. It's because it's true. I have not seen much Classic Who. I'm trying to catch up though on the movie here.
Well, these are really the iconic episodes, you know, which is what they're taking, even out of those subsets, they're taking what they would consider to be the, you know, the jewel and the crown for each one of these Doctors. Mm-hmm. They just happen to coincide very well with the Classic Who selections that they just recently dropped onto Netflix as well. So
imagine that.
Yeah, I'm willing to wager that, you know, if you're choosing the cream of the crop for these episodes, then you're gonna have other means of access to them than BBC America. But it'd be interesting to see what they use as their selections, you know, just for the sake of, you know, a betting pool kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, you have to understand there's a lot of episodes that have been lost completely that just no longer exist. So, when, you know, I was thinking, how would it be different if those could actually be part of the pool?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, there was the first part of a two-part published interview with one of the set designers that was the principal guy responsible for the new TARDIS interior design.
Okay.
I don't know if you caught that. I'll have to find the link and share it out with you later so you can include it with the link dump when the episode goes out. But it was basically, you know, echoing a lot of what Moffat had said about the reasons why they wanted to change it around, why they wanted to give it more of a dark or a ship-like tone. It had gotten kind of whimsical, I guess they had said, to a certain degree, why they went some of the actual design routes that they did. But in terms of the layout, that was really a matter of practicality. They were having issues when they wanted to do they wanted to start moving the cameras around so that they get shots from different perspectives around the interior, and they couldn't access it. It was very stage-like in terms of having like a three-quarter thrust, and they couldn't get the camera crews around for certain angles, so they were always forced to work within the same 60-degree radius. So by repositioning and sort of pushing the control console out towards the middle of the soundstage and things like that, they've been able to free up the camera crew to get different shots. So we'll get different angles of the interior too. We might finally see what the TARDIS looks like when the door on the way in is on the right of the screen and things like that, you know.
That is awesome. That's exciting.
Yeah.
That totally made sense to me. As soon as they include that, you know, I did one of those forehead slaps. Oh, okay, now I get it. All right.
Okay, yeah. At least it's not just, oh, I'm bored, I need a new set, you know.
Yeah.
All right, so what is the story about Karen Gillan's Twitter account?
Well, it's there's been a lot of discussion. Twitter's such a weird forum to begin with for a lot of celebrity to fan base discussions. And, you know, we've gone on and on to mention the fact, and they have to mention this every couple of days to say, you know, Matt Smith and Jenna Louise Coleman do not have Twitter accounts, nor do they plan on having Twitter accounts. So anyone who claims that they're them is obviously being falsified, and you know, don't take any of that information, you know, as gospel or what have you. But then on the related note, Karen Gillan and a lot of the other previous companions have their own accounts and are still followed very closely. And I guess Karen's account had the password compromised at some point in the last week or so, going on close to 2 weeks back now, and was taken over by one of these bots that just basically, you know, farms passwords until it breaks through, and then it starts tweeting on behalf of that individual. This one happened to be promoting weight loss pills about 2 days before, you know, she caught on that something was weird and, you know, was able to, you know, to wrench control back. But, yeah, watch your passwords, kids. Change them regularly. Yeah. It happens to the best of us.
We do have a confirmed date for the Doctor returning.
Yay. Yeah, this is the biggest news. This is the biggest confirmed news.
Yes.
Yeah, so the Doctor Who will be returning on March 30th. This is BBC One. This isn't confirmed for BBC America yet, but you know, they've been following the trend of simulcasting. So it's a fair bet to say that this is when we're also going to get it, but just
correct that. Same day casting.
Well, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it's a couple hours later.
Yes. So, but yeah, it's safe to say that that's probably the day we're going to get it, but just as the little asterisk, we've got to say that, you know, it hasn't been confirmed for us yet.
And they'll poke around with that for a little while just because it keeps people talking. If they don't confirm it, you know, they wait a couple of extra weeks or even as much as a month or so longer to lock that in. It at least keeps people discussing it and
yeah. You know,
keeps it relevant. And because they are continuing to gain momentum in the U.S. market as we go. You know, we talk about it a lot because we're sort of, you know, we see things through a bit of a filter, you know, because of the fact that most of the people that we may connect with through online media and things like that happen to share these interests. So when we talk doctor things, other people understand doctor things that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm still at the point, you know, where I'm walking through major metro areas and I'm either, you know, sporting my TARDIS hoodie or I've got a short sleeve on. So my TARDIS on the back of my arm is showing my tattoos and whatnot. People still don't get it. Still don't recognize it.
Honestly, I'm at the point still where it's, I'll be walking around with one of my t-shirts on and somebody's like, oh man, I love that shirt. And I'm like, really? You get that? You do know that this isn't Bill and Ted, right? You know?
So. I have shouted at people from across the street. I like your shirt. What? I like your shirt. I go out of my way to recognize the Whovians when I see them in the wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got a little better concentration in the greater Manhattan area.
Yeah. So there are a lot of us here.
Yeah, down here in San Antonio, you know, the geek culture hasn't really broken through yet.
Go figure.
Imagine that. You know, if we could just get away from the rodeos for a little bit, it might happen, but you know.
At least you guys had 75 degree weather. Well, I'm in New York where it was, I think, 11 or 12 degrees today.
Yeah, I've got my AC on and I'm still sweating. It's, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway,
weather talk. This is exciting.
Yeah. One more thing that I found earlier on BBCAmerica.com, this there was this great TARDIS like ball gown. Did you guys see that?
Oh, the girl with the interior panel.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all seen the TARDIS dresses at from, you know, cons and things like that. They, I mean, some of them are actually really cool, but this is a really, really neat take on it. Where it's
really original take, yeah.
Yeah. So it, I mean, it's, it looks like a standard TARDIS ball gown, and then she pulls open the flap on the actual dress part of it, and there is a painted control room there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm trying to recall, I haven't looked at the picture in a couple of days now, as to which interior. It must have been before the most recent change.
Yeah, it's,
I think it depends, yeah, right?
Well, no, it's, it looks like 11s, but
it's 11s, but it's the original 11s. It's not this dark, techie.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, it looks like it's the Pawn version. It's stylized. It's not a picture perfect representation, but it's,
it looks almost like a graphic novel shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, sort of paintbrush, but very well done, just the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm fully in support of any kind of interesting cosplay from Doctor Who. It's, or any sort of cosplay, really, but especially when it pertains to Doctor Who, I get especially giddy. I've been looking forward to this episode because I love Donna. I'm just going to say that right now. She is awesome.
You can't not. I mean, you think, we've been talking for a while about previous companions and some of the things that endear us towards one, and, or maybe leaves us away from others. And some of the things that keep coming around are the fact that, this romantic involvement stuff that just keeps undermining the relationship so that they can't really accomplish anything because they're busy getting googly-eyed and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and of course all kind of came to a head with Martha and so on. Well, you couldn't get much more of a clean break.
Yeah. I mean,
this is the cold shower that David Tennant needed to break him out of this and let him focus on being a doctor again.
Yeah, so I mean, Catherine Tate, she's a very accomplished comedic actress in England. She had her own sketch comedy show, and I'm not sure how reliable this story is. I've heard it a number of times, so I tend to think that it's true, but she was actually a fan of Doctor Who and wanted to be involved in it. So she, you know, wrote to people and, you know, tried to get involved in everything. And then finally, they threw her in as a one-time companion for the Runaway Bride. Yeah. And apparently just the connection between David Tennant and Catherine Tate, the chemistry was so fantastic that they decided to bring her back as a full-time companion for the fourth series. Okay. So it was basically just a story of a fan pestering the right people for long enough that they finally included her.
Perfect.
That's similar to what happened with David Tennant himself.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And then it just took the right people giving him a chance, saying, okay, we'll try it out, and then them proving that they could handle it.
And I mean, I'm glad they took a chance on her. I think though her character was a little bit different after Runaway Bride.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I could not stand her in Runaway Bride, and I still have a hard time watching that Christmas special just because of Donna.
Well, she was so loud and so boorish and so forceful and just two-dimensional. I mean, they didn't really give her an opportunity to soften much at all. I mean, there was the one moment on the rooftop where, you know, they had, you know, a little bit of a heart-to-heart, but it lasted all about 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And then, you know, right back to screaming and yelling and stupid Martian, you know.
Yeah, so it that one was a bit rough, and thankfully when she came back, it was, you know, they had toned her down a little bit and gave her a little bit of a gentler tone.
Yeah. And I think they did it expertly. They made it like it was the doctor's influence on her.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "Because of you, I started learning about things."
Yeah. And they gave her, within those first couple of episodes, and we'll talk about this, gave her opportunities to be exposed to things, you know, as she started traveling with the Doctor. And in the first couple episodes, the first couple things she gets exposed to are these instances where she's shocked and appalled at the behavior of different races, different, you know, different cultures and things, or just the Doctor's own reactions to things, you know, thinking specifically of Pompeii and things like that. So we get a chance to see a more humane, or at least human, Donna, when she, you know, brings the levels down a little bit and really starts to open up what matters to her, what bothers her, what, you know, what concerns her.
Yeah.
And it really was exactly what we wanted from the character, and we get it right up front. So it puts everything on an even keel, like, okay, all right, this is going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, I mean, that really did help to separate the full-time companion from the one-off that we had. Because, I mean, when I got to the end of Series 3 and started Series 4, and I saw Catherine Tate pop up on screen, my first reaction was, oh, dear God, I'm going to have to skip a whole season. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think that I was going to be able to, but I gave it a chance. I watched Partners in Crime, and by the time the Doctor and Donna had that exchange through the office, you know, their little mime conversation, I was rolling, and I was like, okay, this is good. This will work.
Very much so.
Yeah, I think that scene was everyone's kind of moment with Donna. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love that whole episode. I just watched Partners in Crime this morning.
Yeah, because, I mean, you get enough of the old Donna, the slightly obnoxious kind of, like, you know, over-the-top things, that, but it was... She was silent, so it was much more palatable. And then you really got to enjoy the comedy.
Yeah, and that was the thing. I mean, you couldn't take an actress that has that background and expect her to be the, you know, the starry-eyed, let's go see the breadth of time and space and just be fascinated by all of the Doctor's, you know, intelligence and erratic brilliance. She's a comedic actress and an extremely talented one. She's Britain's answer to Carol Burnett, you know. So she's going to bring that in. And it's funny because I think she brought more of that comedic delivery out of Tennant that he didn't really have the opportunity to do with his previous companions. He was endearing. He was funny at times. He, you know, he'd make you chuckle, but they had out and out slapstick moments between he and Donna that were just strictly there for the hell, for the fun of it, you know, and they were really enjoying it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one thing you can see, you know, with the previous companions, you know, he didn't have a chance to be funny. You know, he would set up a joke and then instead of, you know, like, giving him what he needed to finish it, they'd be like, whatever you say, Doctor, you know, just completely drooling over him. And it's like, you know, he couldn't give the punchline.
But, or the joke was in the fact that he was delivering something and no one else would get it.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, with Catherine Tate and David Tennant, you know, even off screen, like outside of the show, you can tell the two have fun. They are friends and they have a lot of fun. You know, I mean, they're so many videos floating around of the two of them outside of the show that you know, are worth watching just because they're comedy gold.
Yeah.
And they did the, was it the Ballad of Russell and Julie for the rap party?
Yeah, for the rap party that season, which, with Barrowman. And it was great. They had the full song written out. They got the whole cast and crew involved in the production of the thing. And for anyone who hasn't had a chance to see it, go ahead and put the time aside and just apologize to your family because you're going to be humming for a while.
Yes, you will.
It's one of those infectious kind of tunes. But just really well done, especially when you get John Barrowman involved because of his, you know, his musical background and things. So, just a lot of fun. You could tell, I would imagine that by the time they got around to doing, you know, episodes 12, 13 or so, during that season, when I don't really know I guess they probably, I'm trying to think, the production-wise, they probably didn't have the three of them on set together often.
No, it was really just for the last two episodes, for the finale.
But even then, I think they were all shot separately because the Torchwood set was not in the same location within Cardiff where they would shoot a lot of the location work for Doctor Who.
Yeah, it was mostly scenes where they were talking like on webcam or something.
Yeah. They'd be at the hub in Cardiff, you know, finger quoties here. but it was a very different physical set location for a lot of the stuff they did for the TARDIS interior and set. Let's take these apart because we started talking before we started the cast about, you know, is it even possible when we're talking about Donna episodes, whether you can say, well, this one, this really wasn't very Donna-centric. In a lot of these, it doesn't matter. As long as she's there, she's contributing some.
Yeah, and I mean, that's part of the problem we ran into with Martha was, you know, a lot of the episodes were Doctor-centric and she really didn't have a chance to shine, but with Donna, it's like she doesn't have to be the center of attention to be stealing the scene.
Or at least driving the scene because of the fact that she was unlike maybe not Rose so much, but with Martha didn't really question much. So she didn't really drive the Doctor to make explanations for the sake of, you know, his companion or for us in that matter. So he had to just sort of fall upon a lot of exposition. Whereas Donna would either outright question because she wanted to understand, or she would challenge because she's Donna.
Yeah.
Right.
And would demand explanation. So that got us as the viewers a lot of the information that we needed when things were going sideways and we didn't understand what the hell was going on. Like, so, you know, I'm thinking of like specifically things like the, Silence in the Library and cases like that. So we mentioned the Runaway Bride, as far as our first exposure.
Yeah. And as much crap as I like to give Donna in that, I think that it wouldn't have fit had you not had a character like that, because you had the Doctor who just lost Rose. I mean, that was a devastating blow to him. And then Donna shows up out of nowhere, and you know, if you hadn't had someone that was so brash and so loud, then it would have been very easy for the Doctor to fall into some, you know, depression and melancholy. But because it was Donna, because she was that character, she kept pushing him and kept, you know, infuriating him so that he couldn't dwell on the fact that Rose had just gone.
Yeah. He couldn't wallow because she kept punching him repeatedly, verbally.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But then we have her proper introduction as a full-time companion in Partners of Crime.
Right. Now, explain the bumper is the fact that we, you know, we have this understanding we gained through the episode, the fact that in this lapse in between Runaway Bride and coming back around again in Partners in Crime, Donna has been very similarly to what happened with Sarah Jane when she was no longer in the Doctor's company. She felt this compelling need to continue learning and finding and questioning and figuring out because of, you know, how her horizons had been expanded. So she took it upon herself and seemed to be pretty damn effective in her downtime. She kept herself pretty busy.
Yeah, and I mean the comedy in the timing between the Doctor and
popping up and down cubicles and all that.
Yeah, walking in the door at different times and just like being right there next to each other through the whole thing and never seeing each other.
That's again, that was a great lead in to anyone coming into the top of that season to say, all right, these two are going to have, you know, some great moments together, just from a comedic standpoint, enjoying, you know, each other, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And this episode, let's not forget, also introduced her grandfather, who I think is just a big contribution to this season. And Wolfram, he wasn't in The Runaway Bride. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Just seeing him on camera is one of those dusty moments, because he's just – he is probably the purest character I think he exceeds Rory's father in terms of sheer, I want to keep this man in my pocket and just take him out and have nice talks over tea with him all the time.
Yeah. And I'd heard people talking at one point about the possibility of saying, like, you know, the Doctor running into, like, World War II era and bumping into a young
Mott.
And I, as awesome as that would be, it would basically just be fan leak because, I mean, you can't have Wilfred Mott without Bernard Cribbins. I mean, he is the reason why that character is so popular. Mm-hmm. So for them to try and bring someone else in to fill the role, even, I don't care how good a job they do, it wouldn't be right.
I think it would also take away from the story because it's so much Donna. You know, he's originally, he likes the Doctor because he's happy for Donna meeting a man that, you know.
But let's just note, because we were talking about in terms of what Donna gains out of each of these experiences. We have that nice conversation, you know, at the end of Partners in Crime where the decision is being posed as to whether or not she's going to come along. You know, she's got her bags packed. She's kind of, you know, pushing her way into the TARDIS. And, you know, which room is going to be mine? You know, she's got everything set and ready to go. So it's, you can tell that a great length has been spanned from the get me back to the church, you spaceman, to, you know, when do we leave? I got to go drop off my keys with the family. So.
And as far as I can remember, the only companion to ever pick herself for companion instead of being picked by the Doctor.
Yes.
Because most everyone else, it was either, you know, he invited them or they just kind of gradually became part of the entourage. But Donna didn't wait. She didn't get asked or anything. It was just like, okay, I'm coming with. And she walked right past him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was packed with her hat box and everything all ready to go.
Yeah.
Coleman has come close. Oswin is probably, and we've been drawing that parallel, the fact that she's got that Donna Noble-esque sense of pushiness about her or assuredness. But I think it comes from a very different place. With Donna, it's an insecurity, or at least we kind of gather that a lot of it is an insecurity that she hides behind her boorishness. Mm-hmm. And I think, and there's something else going on with Oswin that we'll have yet to figure out.
Yeah, there's a lot to discuss there, or will be anyway.
But then we get to an episode which really surprising, and this, to me personally, this may very well be, I know you're kind of partial to one of the later episodes, but as far as for me, in terms of one of her shining moments, you get to the fires of Pompeii, and we get this right up front.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking the third episode we've had with Donna in it, and it's heavy.
Yeah.
It's extremely heavy.
Yeah, and I mean, you really get to see what Donna's made of in this and how much she values things.
Mm-hmm. And it shows you that she is a true companion for the Doctor. They're all always, you know, he chooses these people for their humanity. I'm reminded of when Cassandra took over Rose and he knows it's not her because Rose would have, you know, would have cared more.
Yeah.
I feel like this is Donna proving herself to be, you know, have that same quality in this episode.
Yeah. And also the first appearance of Karen Gillan in Doctor Who.
You blew my mind when you told me that for the first time.
No, see, this is how you do it right. Freema Agyeman, not how you do it right.
Don't make her a principal character under a different name. Switch it all up and say, no, it was a screen test. That's all. It was just a screen test.
Yeah, no.
Sorry.
So I think the way to become a companion on this show is to get hired on it for something else and wait a year. And
yeah, become an extra and then just keep battering or something.
Yeah.
All right.
Wait, and speaking of the cast on Fires of Pompeii, I only realized it now when I rewatched it. The cabbie from A Study in Pink, Sherlock.
Yes.
The guy.
Well, that actor shows up in quite a bit. He's I think he was also in Life on Mars and a couple of others. You know, the BBC only has 10 actors anyway. So, but no, it's interesting to see him as the soothsayer, and he's been out-soothed and it's a pretty good episode all around. I mean, it had some of its kind of hokey moments to it, but man, when it really comes down to the discussion as to the decision on where to get involved or where you can't be involved, or what is the morality of letting time run its course and such, that just...
It's like, what's the ratio? How many people is it okay to sacrifice, and how many people do you have to be able to save to justify it, you know?
Right. So I have a question. Is the fires of Pompeii, does that take place before or after the episode... The Waters of Mars, where he goes all Time Lord victorious at the end.
That's before. It's well before.
This is before. Okay. So, but there's a progression there then. You know, he's starting to feel like he can control who lives and dies or whatever. You know, this is a fixed point in time, but he still starts to control that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, you can definitely see that kind of grow in him as time goes on. But and one of the few times where it felt right to see the Doctor holding a gun.
Water gun.
Yes. I was like, if he's going to use a water gun, it's going to be a little squirt pistol. And that felt right for the Doctor.
Spoot, spoot.
This is how we fight things. No. All right, so then we move on to Planet of the Udes,
which, from a Donna perspective, in terms of following the progression of the character, is yet another instance where we see her response to the inhumanity of humans,
mm-hmm.
or that idea of these moral decisions.
Yeah, and there's one scene in this episode when. You know, when the Doctor shares their song with her, when he makes it so that she can hear it, that moment won me over on Catherine Tate because, just the look on her face and the tears, I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe what she's suffering through right now. And it was just, and it was such a natural thing that I was like, wow, this really is a fantastic actress, not just comedian. Yeah, mm-hmm. But she's an actress in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
So. I do agree, yeah. I'm a big fan of the episode in general because I love the Ood race and everything that they do with them. I think anytime they have an opportunity to bring them around again, it's just a great involvement because it's such a cryptic kind of presence, you know.
Yeah.
Are they intelligent? Are they subservient? Are they actually a higher form that are in such a state of zen that they don't mind being used as they are? So that whole backdrop, I enjoy thoroughly. And then, the interplay we have with Don and the Doctor involved with them is great too. I think as we get into the next episode, though, I'm going to step back on this one because I wasn't a big fan of the Centaurum stratagem.
Yeah, they had to have a little two-parter in there, and they had to have, something to fill it with, and this just felt like filler. I mean, that's really all it felt like to me.
I watched Centauran Stratagem, I was planning to watch The Poison Sky right after, and I just gave up. I was like, I think I got it.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's exactly the case.
The only thing that I really feel like is a takeaway from that episode is, when Donna's trying to open the door or something, and the Doctor's like, yep, put your hand on the panel. It's like, it's for Centaurans. I need three fingers. And the Doctor's kind of like, Donna, you've got three fingers. Oh yeah. That joke was about the only thing I took away from both of these episodes.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Notice in Partners in Crime that there were Atmos stickers on people's cars. So they were setting it up for a while, at least. I give them credit for that.
Yeah.
That is true. Yeah, they really, at this point in terms of the production, the attention to detail in terms of how they had laid out their scripts in advance and seeded and telegraphed bits. I mean, think about everything they did with, you know, how long did you start seeing Vote Saxon posters?
Oh, yeah, it was.
Yeah, we were just talking about
it.
It
was the very first episode with Martha that, you know, they mentioned Saxon and you see the posters. So it's, they don't waste time dropping
science. Yeah.
All right. So once we get through that, we get to the Doctor's Daughter.
Yeah.
Which is a great episode. I love it. But, you know, not a strong Martha or a strong Donna
episode. Well, no, because through that entire episode, they had us reeling from everything else they were throwing at us, that Donna kind of fell into the periphery because we as viewers were, what the frack is going on? Riddle me this one. What?
But so she was able to, you know, to figure out the coding of the rooms. You know, where they think that it's just a number of the corridor or something, and she's able to figure it out. Like, no, look, there's a pattern here. We're actually getting closer to something. And, you know, so she did have, and, you know, then also able to tell the doctor, look, you're being obnoxious and this, you're breaking this girl's heart, you know, and basically stand up to him and be Donna, you know?
Yeah. So that's rather than the companion being this grounding force or this means of keeping the doctor focused on task or something of that sort, it's an interesting juxtaposition that Donna, of all people, is the one that is pointing out someone's poor behavior or poor lack of tact, so to speak.
Yeah.
Of all people. The irony of it all. So. Yeah. Okay.
Moving right along.
Yeah. Okay.
The Unicorn and the Wasp was, it was a cute little episode, but, you know, ultimately it was, she was the plucky little, you know, the plucky girl that helps him out. You know, she really didn't serve much purpose except for being the doctor's assistant, you know.
Right. I was okay with it. You know, I didn't really have a too much of a problem with it. It wasn't like something like the Centauran Stratagem or Poison Sky where I just kind of said, well, you know, I'm going to clock through it because you're supposed to. It was a nice, you know, for anyone who has, you know, watched Agatha Christie stories on, you know, Masterpiece Theater or that sort of thing, you know, you had your, you know, this great little classic murder mystery. So it was always enjoyable in that regard, but then, you know, it's got the doctor spin to it. I was fine with it.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anything as far as progression of the character or advancement with Donna or even anything memorable that says, you know, oh, it's a great moment where.
Except for, you know, when the doctor got poisoned. when they're trying to detox him in the kitchen, that was good.
True. But from Donna's perspective, in terms of looking at her character, I don't know, I think it was a matter of, yeah, she was a vehicle, you know, yep. Like a lot of characters through it.
Yeah, exactly.
But they make up for it. Yeah. Because then we get into the two-parter for the Silence in the Library.
Yeah, I mean, I still, to this day, when River meets Donna and looks at her like, you're Donna Noble, it was just like, my heart's break. Because it just, she knows what happened, she knows what's coming, and it just the look on her face, like, you know, it is such an honor to meet you. You know, I mean, we've seen River Song, we know what she's capable of, and the fact that she looks up to Donna just speaks volumes.
Yeah, Alex Kingston is great at giving this look of just like respect for the other people on screen, and especially just knowing everything, like you said, that happens to Donna later on. Her River's emotions, her acting takes on a whole another level of significance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good one to go back to, well, for a number of reasons, but to go back to once you've seen the River Song chronology as far as we were exposed to it. You know, looping back to this, you get so much more out of it. And not to pull focus away from, you know, we're discussing Donna here, but just in terms of this was a great example of the complexity of the script work that they were starting to break into. And they were really starting to say, you know what, we may do this occasionally for the sake of fun, but we are not a Rubber Monster of the Week series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got some heady things that we can throw at you. We can make you think, we can make you question, we can make you wonder, we can piss you off through lack of information. and we're going to do it. We're gonna keep you in the dark about a lot of things. You know, no pun intended, Vashti Narada.
Right.
pun intended. But this was, I think, as far as when, you know, we were talking about, you know, what episodes do you hand people who want to know what modern Doctor Who is all about, or you know, what do they need to see? You'd want to include this for a number of reasons,
yeah.
but that list of reasons is long, because these two episodes do a lot to define what this show is all about.
Yeah, they really do.
Not to mention the fact that as far as villains go, they didn't get to use them that often, but man, Vashti Narada, you know, having the skull in the spacesuit thing. That's still a costume I'm going to be working on for years ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, they did the Vashti Narada. I'm glad that they didn't become another Weeping Angels. Like if the Weeping Angels had stuck to the episode Blink, they would have been one of the scariest things of all time. Now it's like they're up there, but maybe there's some debate or whatever. Like Vashti Narada stayed in these two episodes, and like it was just, I think that makes it all the creepier.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we've got the moments in these episodes that just stick with you. You know, that Donna Noble has left the library. Donna Noble has been saved.
That is, you know, we're talking about cosplay. I'm going to try to convince somebody for Dragon Con this year that they need to be a node. I will make them a foam node head so that they can walk around.
That would be awesome.
But it's got to be real simple, you know. You just put yourself in white pajamas and whatnot, and just get a big. Get some, like upholstery foam and cut it into a big tear-shaped, egg-shaped thing.
Yeah,
stick your face through it. And I'm sorry, it still baffles people when they go back and see these episodes, was that one of the heads in the node there was Prince Charming from Once Upon a Time. So,
I'm gonna have to go back and watch that now.
Yep, check Tumblr, it's all over. You see all these people's heads explode when they realize that's Prince Charming in a node. But,
so wait, the whole story of Once Upon a Time is taking place inside of a computer simulation. Oh my god!
What?
I wouldn't put it past that show. I really wouldn't.
Well, we're jumping series here.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought that when we talked about this two-part that we were going to skip over Forest of the Dead because, you know, Donna wasn't in that much because, you know, she was a node. And then I remembered, no wait, she was in that simulation.
Yeah.
And there was a lot for her to go into in that.
Yeah, you talk about her being an actress. This is another.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. As far as taking this alternate life of hers, really interesting to see the situation that she does find herself in this not real reality. So, you know, what was your take on how they chose to represent not Donna?
I think, you know, just there were so many emotional upheavals in that story. You know, it's like you see Donna just completely happy and, you know, completely okay with her life, which we haven't seen yet except for when she's with the doctor. You know, she's always looking for that perfect life that she wants except when she's around the doctor. And here she has that perfect life. And then, you know, it starts to get chipped away. And piece by piece, you see it start to crumble and see how she handles it. You know, and I mean, I've got to say when the kids vanish, I mean, as a parent, that's one of my like innate fears is, you know, I feel like as a father, my duty is to protect my kids. That's number one. And seeing her reaction when they vanished, it just, I mean, I get chills and I get choked up every time. She nailed that emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that really brings out the best in all of the performances going on, and bear in mind that, you know, at the director's helm for both of these episodes was Moffat.
Yeah.
So that drives quite a bit. You know you're going to be pulling the best of a phenomenal cast when you've got him at the helm, and it was Shades of Things to Come.
Yeah.
So. Definitely.
You know, and then the end of the episode when, you know, I forget the guy's name, but when he tries to call out for Donna but can't because of a stutter.
Oh my God. Right in the feels. That's the saddest moment of the season.
Yeah. I mean, that really was just like, oh! But, you know, and then, so then we go into, well, Midnight she wasn't even really in.
Yeah, that just gave us an opportunity to get back to kind of, all right, let's take a little breather here. Let's have a little fun. If we're going to have Donna in it, let's give her an opportunity to kind of be loud and obnoxious for a little while because she's on vacation.
So, and I think it was kind of interesting how they did this. It's like you've got, you know, Donna gets a week off in Midnight and then the doctor gets a week off in Turn Left.
Yeah.
I have to say that if we're talking about episodes that define Donna, you don't get any more serious than Turn Left.
Yeah.
This shows exactly how important she is, exactly how every aspect of her life plays into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This was just as far as the whole time play, you know, getting into the ideas of alternate realities or alternate timelines or what happens in the infinite number of possibilities that drive through everything. This was a very well written episode. You know, Graham Harper as your principal writer on this one, you know, and again, and his writing continuing through Stolen Earth and Journey's End to wrap up the season, he is just phenomenal in terms of how complex he chooses to make the material and yet spells it out in ways that we can follow, you know, even though we are not astrophysicists and we are not, you know, the means being able to take apart some very complex, you know, concepts of temporal distortion and what have you. But I think the only thing that I think bothered me, I was upset with the whole, Rose Tyler thing that the first time I had seen it, I'm like, wait a second. And that it almost pulled me out of the episode for a little while. But if it wasn't for the fact that the Catherine Tate's performance, especially towards the third act of the episode, when she's just having a breakdown at the realization that none of this should have been, was just brilliant on her part.
Oh, yeah.
You know, her face as she's standing in the circle of mirrors and she sees the thing on her back and she's panicked over that. I mean, she's disgusted and freaked out at the fact that she's got this giant scarab on her back.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. But at the same time, she's having this lofty information thrown at her about the fact that she has to correct this and undo everything that she's known.
Yeah.
And she's processing all of that at once.
And not just that, but the fact that, you know, she has to sacrifice herself to do it.
Well, she gets that in the final seconds of that exchange. But,
But I mean, the fact that she is dealing with all of this, and then to learn that in order to do that, she has to die, and there's no, you know, no further explanation of if you do that, then this reality is erased. You're going to be fine. You'll never even. It's just like you have to kill yourself to fix this. And what does she do? She goes and does it. You know, she's like, this is not how the world's supposed to be. I can fix this. And so she sacrifices herself to save everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just to see how, you know, the one simple act of her stopping the doctor from sacrificing himself, you know, affected the outcome of the entire course of history, you know, and then seeing her cope with each and every obstacle that comes.
Yeah, including landing a half mile from where she needs to be.
Yeah.
The final moments run across London. Yeah, this is the quintessential Donna episode.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to tell someone about Donna Noble, like sum Donna Noble up in one episode, this is the one to do it. Unfortunately, you can't without all the backstory that goes with it, but this is Donna.
Right. If you want to know why she is critical,
mm-hmm.
this is it.
Yeah, I mean, this is why, you know, River was so happy to meet her,
mm-hmm.
and so sad as well. Yeah, but
but then, well, our two-part finale here. She kind of, because of the fact that you've got this ensemble cast.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, it is, you couldn't pack many more people into the next two episodes without dragging people out of their graves. So we don't get a whole lot of Donna representation.
Yep.
Other than the fact that she does serve to be, again, she goes back to being that questioning, sort of a fresh set of eyes, and a willingness to open her mouth when they're trying to determine, you know, where the Earth has gone, in Stolen Earth, and sort of drive the doctor when they go to see the, help me out here, the Shadow
Proclamation.
Proclamation, sorry. I was going to say Continuum, but that would just be dumb. But by the time we get into Journey's End, her involvement really becomes ancillary. Again,
yeah.
Because now it becomes the freaking, you know, we've got everybody under the sun, you know, five different points of battle going on. We've got everybody merging, bringing their stories together. Torchwood's going berserk. We've got Mickey's back in the picture, for crying out loud.
Yeah. So happy to see Mickey back.
But I
think that it was hilarious to see her play the, you know, the human Time Lord hybrid. You know, her as the Dr. Donna was fantastic.
Yeah, that was the best way to see it all out, was to give her the kick-ass power position that we knew that, you know, if you were to take any one of our human companions and give her infinite power and want to fear her, who would it? Let me think about that for a second. You got Martha, who would just kind of smile a lot and say, look, I've got powers. You got Rose, who would just get overly emotional about her powers.
And then vaporize entire species.
Exactly. And then you've got Donna, who takes that on and just, you know, like...
takes it in stride.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a diamond rhino. Yeah. You wanna make the Daleks actually feel fear? There you go.
Yeah. And I think that the way that the episode ended, I still feel like this is the saddest departure of companions from New Who.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. We've talked about that before. This is, because I think Rose could be the runner up there, but this exact story arc is what makes her story less compelling than it used to be. Like, yeah. You know, I'm glad that she ends up with the doctor or whatever, but like, you know, that's different. That's Rose. This was definitely, Donna's story is the most, hard hitting.
Rose lost someone that she cared about. Donna lost who she was supposed to be. And I think that's what makes it so devastating is we've run from the runaway bride all the way through. We have seen her grow. We've talked about what makes her so awesome that someone like River Song looks up to her. And then she has to forget everything that makes her that person. Everything that has made her happy for, you know, the past year or however long it had been is stripped away from her. And she, not that she lost it, but the fact that she can't even know about it.
Yeah.
And that's just devastating on so many levels.
I mean, yeah, I agree. They try to give us a little happy ending for her, but it's still just comparatively, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I have nothing to add to what you just said, but I totally agree.
It's an interesting little coda, though, that the doctor sort of instills that bit of information to Sylvia, the mother, and to Wilfred, so that they get some reassurance that there is, because obviously, you know, she's being kind of restored back to that chavvy state,
yeah, the factory, you know, settings.
Yeah, which were not exactly endearing.
Yeah, no.
But with that one nod, that at least gives us as the viewer some sort of a hope that maybe she'll progress beyond that on her own accord. Because if the people around her that are her, you know, her family, her protectors, her providers know that she's capable of better things, they'll be able to help, you know, nature versus nurture steer her into that or to something better. You know, the whole idea of trying to impress upon Sylvia that if she can be a little better to her daughter, that she'll see better things from her. Mm-hmm. At least it gives me, at a moment when I've already been kind of hollowed out by what we've been forced to accept, that's at least a little bit of a helping hand before the episode closes.
Yeah. And then we do get to see her get married at the end of the series finale. But I still, like, you know, she comes out in the wedding dress all happy and everything, and I know that you're supposed to be happy for her at that point, but my brain goes back to, no, she's not supposed to be with that guy. She's supposed to be with the guy from the library. You know, I can't be happy for her because she went for second best and she doesn't even know it. But I don't know. But I mean, all in all,
pessimistic way of looking at it.
That's me. But I have to say that Donna is probably my favorite companion so far. I mean, it's really close between her and Rory, but as far as, like, you know, proper companion, like, you know, obviously Amy was the companion and Rory was the tag along. So if we're looking at just proper companions of the four of them that we've had in New Who so far, Donna is by far my favorite. Mm-hmm. You know, she's everything that I could want a companion to be with none of the emotional drama that comes with it.
Yeah. And I think that's all the discussions I've had with numerous Whovians of all race, color, creed, shape, and age have all said that whether or not they want to actually claim Donna as their preferred companion, they all have an immense amount of respect for what she did for the show for the advancement of the of our expectations from companions. Mm-hmm. Because I think that I don't think they could have made a transition into someone like Amy Pond without having Donna there to really put some corners back on. You know, we had all the edges rounded between Rose and Martha and such, and things were getting kind of, you know.
Donna proved that you could have a companion without making it a love story.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's when the show is at its greatest, when you've got these people that work well together but don't have the romantic entanglements.
Right.
That's why I'm scared for Oswin or Clara. Like, I'm afraid they're just going to go right back to the romance.
I'm being optimistic that it was just the one kiss and it's not going to continue. I think that I'm hoping that they learn their lesson from Rose and Martha and say, okay, we can have them admire the Doctor, but they don't have to be infatuated with him. You know.
I think it'd be better if they sort of develop into running buddies. They can be very chummy, and I have no problem with that, you know, because they're both youthful and adventurous and slightly crazy and fearless that way.
I'd even be okay with occasional flirtatiousness as long
as I'd be okay with all the flirting. That's
as long as it doesn't lead anywhere, then right. Yeah,
which requires the occasional intervention of Alex Kingston to come in like a velvet hammer and just break that crap up.
But no, because even if bringing her in would legitimize the relationship aspect. If they're just flirting, like that could be just people who run into each other and flirt or whatever. But like if River is there and she's jealous or something, then it becomes a whole shipper triangle thing.
Oh, but do you seriously think that River would stand for anyone flirting with the Doctor, even if it was completely innocent?
She'd be in her place with one line, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway. Well, I mean, that's about all we've got for Donna. You guys have anything in closing?
Keep tabs with, Catherine Tate is still working very hard. She's got a lot of things that she continues to get her hands on.
She was actually in the American version of The Office as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Looks very different.
Yeah.
If you haven't noticed, she's definitely kind of got the posh on these days. Mm-hmm. But if you have not had an opportunity to see her stand-up comedy work, her variety and sketch comedy work, track it down, because she's one of the funniest women that you can come across.
Yeah, I mean, if you just YouTube her, you will find like hundreds of clips. Funny.
Yeah, and I mean they're hilarious. So definitely. Definitely check her out wherever you can. It's about time for us to wrap up, so this has been episode 22 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I ain't bothered.
And this is Melissa saying, you're not made with me, sweetheart.
And this is Care saying, what? What? What?
See you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week on iTunes or at gallifreypublicradio.podbean.com. Have something you want to say or just want to say hello? Send us an email at gallifreypublicradio@gmail.com or on Twitter @gallifreyradio. We love getting comments, so head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating and your comment on the show. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict. Sorry, you came in like halfway through that sentence. I'm not sure what you were saying.
I wasn't saying anything. I have nothing to say.
Well, then it came across beautifully.
Why don't you just pull the pantyhose over your head and...
and then go grab myself a soda from the store real quick. And...
it's just a thought.
It was, you know, the... What are you doing with the notes?
I don't know. I don't know how that happened.
Control C. Undo.
Didn't work.
We've lost an episode entirely. It's the unaired episode.